VOA One, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Katie Weaver, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, hundreds of tour buses, boats, and three-wheeled motorized tuk-tuks sit unused across Thailand's capital, Bangkok. The coronavirus pandemic and a lack of foreign tourists have brought the transport industry to a halt. Lunar New Year celebrations began on Friday. In normal years, the holiday would bring a rise in spending and travel among Thais. It also would bring visitors from China and other places in Asia. Tuk-tuks, buses, and boats would be in high demand. But the pandemic has left many drivers and owners struggling economically. A recent study predicted Lunar New Year spending would suffer its sharpest fall in 13 years. Kraisat Kunkyatpraset rents tuk-tuks to drivers. Recently, he has been renting out no more than 10 vehicles a day. In the past, he would rent out more than 100 in a day. These tuk-tuks have been parked for a year. You can see them all covered with dust, Kraisat said. I will monitor the situation for another year, he added. If it doesn't get better, I will have to shut down. Kampontike is a 50-year-old tuk-tuk driver. He said he had earned only 50 baht after driving for hours a day earlier. But he felt he had no chance of finding another job. In another part of Bangkok, long lines of passenger tour buses sit empty. Before the COVID pandemic, I've never been short of work, said driver Tasapon Rakrachakan. He remembers busy days in the past when he would drop off one group of passengers and immediately pick up another. It's been a year now, and there's been no movement at all, Tasapon added. Wasuchet Soponsiatien is president of the Thai Transportation Operators Association. He said only about 10% of Thailand's 40,000 tour buses were still operating. The story is the same for many tour boats. Mani Hokontat is a 54-year-old boat driver. In the past, passengers would fill his boat. But now, things are completely different. I have been thinking about finding a new job, he said. But I am worried that I have to start from zero because of my work experience and age.
A program supported by the United Nations says it is ready to deploy coronavirus vaccines to the neediest people, especially in poor countries. The COVAX program announced its plans last week to provide 100 million doses of vaccine by the end of March. It expects to give out 200 million more doses by July. Leaders of COVAX said most of the doses for the first distribution will come from British-Swedish drug maker AstraZeneca. The company's partner, the Serum Institute of India, will also provide doses of the same vaccine. Frederick Christensen co-leads the program Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation. He told a video news conference that the plans come at an important time as new forms of the coronavirus have appeared. We are on a path to really start balancing out the problem of wealthy countries being vaccinated before poorer countries, he said.
Dr. Seth Berkley leads the international nonprofit organization Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. It is administering the COVAX program along with the World Health Organization and the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. Berkley said COVAX plans the first distribution of 336 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to go to several countries until June. Gavi expects that nearly 100 million of those doses will start being distributed to targeted countries by the end of March, officials said. Another 1.2 million doses of the vaccine from companies Pfizer and BioNTech are expected to be shared by 18 countries in the first 3 months of the year. The companies already have been selling and distributing their vaccine to wealthy countries. Of course, we would like more BioNTech vaccines in the first and second parts of the year, said Berkley. That is what we were offered, given the demand and supply that was there. Berkley noted that AstraZeneca vaccine's first distribution was 57 million doses fewer than had been planned. He said delays were caused by countries needing emergency use approval from the World Health Organization. He noted it was not a result of supply problems, like those in Europe.
The AstraZeneca vaccine distribution depends on the World Health Organization giving emergency use permission, which is expected this month. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine is already approved. Supplying it to poorer nations is difficult because the vaccine must be stored at extremely cold temperatures. Gavi pointed to a number of issues that could still hurt plans for the distribution. The group said the plan requires regulatory approvals, supplies, coordination, and the readiness of countries to receive the vaccines. About 190 countries and territories that are taking part in the COVAX plan have been waiting for details. That includes upper and middle income countries that have paid money and 93 lower income countries which are expected to benefit.
India is expected to get most of the 240 million AstraZeneca doses that the Serum Institute is producing. Pakistan is to receive over 17 million, while Malawi is to get nearly 1.5 million doses, and Haiti, about 876,000. A South Korean factory is producing another 96 million doses of the AstraZeneca product. Brazil is expected to receive over 10 million doses, Egypt more than 5.1 million, Iran over 4.2 million, and Canada more than 1.9 million. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm John Russell.
A social media app called Clubhouse, which became popular for political discussions in China, has been blocked within the country. Thousands of Chinese users had recently been using the app to discuss issues that are often censored in China. Earlier this week, users began reporting difficulties connecting to the service. Clubhouse was blocked in China around 11 UTC on Monday, reported GreatFire.org. The American nonprofit group watches developments in China's huge internet filtering system and tries to help users get around it. Officials from Clubhouse and China's Cyberspace Administration had no immediate comment on the blockage. Clubhouse was launched in March 2020 by two American businessmen. The app permits users to communicate through audio in virtual discussion rooms. There are many rooms covering different subjects, and users can create their own room. People who want to join the app must be approved after receiving an invitation from someone who already has it. Users seeking acceptance are required to provide their names and telephone numbers. That requirement raised questions about the possibility the government may have listened to private discussions on Clubhouse and could try to punish users. There were no signs that such punishments had yet happened, the Associated Press reported. One user warned others, "I advise everyone not to use your real photo as your profile picture and not to link your Clubhouse account to your Twitter." China's ruling Communist Party also blocks access to Facebook, Twitter, and other social media services. Also blocked are websites run by news organizations, human rights groups, and pro-democracy activists. The internet filtering system is known as China's Great Firewall. Users within China can still access blocked apps like Clubhouse using a virtual private network, or VPN. A VPN uses software to link to private computer networks outside the country to make it appear that the device or computer is based overseas. CNN reported that many people were using VPNs to stay on Clubhouse. One such user who spoke to the news network was Susan Liang from Shenzhen. "It is too rare an opportunity. Everyone has lived under the Great Firewall for so long, but on Clubhouse we can talk about anything," Liang said. "It's like someone drowning and can finally breathe in a large gulp of air." However, she said some people also fear being targeted for using VPNs, which are illegal in China unless approved by the government. Another user advised people not to discuss which VPN they were now using to access the app. While Clubhouse was still available, VOA Mandarin observed several Chinese language rooms where users joined discussions on wide-ranging and sensitive subjects. These included Uyghur rights, the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, Taiwan's independence, China's national identity, and gender issues. However, the Chinese government tightly controls online discussion within the country. Many users said they were not surprised when the app was blocked. After seeing people discuss so many political issues here in previous days, I knew right away that Clubhouse would be walled, and so it was, one user said. Yachio Wang is a researcher with Human Rights Watch. She said on the organization's website that people from all sides of politics came together to discuss important issues, with many disagreements arising. But, Wang added, people on Clubhouse appeared to truly try and put themselves in the shoes of others. It was wonderful to see a unifying internet in which Chinese speakers from around the world communicated with each other in one shared online space. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger movement of organized labor in America. Sarah Long and Doug Johnson continue the story of the presidency of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies during the 1930s changed the face of American government. The new president and the Congress passed legislation that helped farmers, strengthened the banking system, and supplied jobs for millions of workers. One of the most important results of Roosevelt's policies was a stronger American labor movement.
Labor leaders had little success in organizing workers in the United States during the 1920s. Three Republican presidents and a national wave of conservatism prevented them from gaining many members or increasing their negotiating power. In 1929, organized labor fell even further with the beginning of the Great Economic Depression. By 1933, America's labor unions had less than 3 million members. But by the end of the 1930s, more than 10.5 million American workers belonged to unions.
New laws proposed by the Roosevelt administration made the labor growth possible. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 gave labor leaders the right to organize and represent workers. The Supreme Court ruled that the law was illegal. But another law, the Wagner Labor Relations Act of 1935, helped labor unions to increase their power. Most of the leaders of America's traditional labor unions were slow to understand their new power. They were conservative men. They represented workers with certain skills, such as woodworkers or metal workers. They did little to organize workers with other kinds of skills. But a new group of labor leaders used the new laws to organize unions by industries, not by skills. They believed that workers would have much more power if they joined forces with other workers in the same factory to make common demands. These new leaders began to organize unions for the automobile industry, the steel industry, and other major industries.
The leader of the new movement was the head of the mine workers, John L. Lewis. Lewis was a powerful leader with a strong body and strong opinions. He had begun to work in the coal mines at the age of 12. Lewis rose to become a powerful and successful leader of the mine workers, but he was concerned about workers in other industries as well, and he believed that most of the leaders in the American Federation of Labor were doing little to help them. For this reason, Lewis and the heads of several other unions formed their own group to organize unions by industry, not by skills. They called their group the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and they tried immediately to gain members.
The CIO successfully organized the workers in several major industries, but it succeeded only by hard work and struggle. The CIO's first big battle was against the giant automobile company, General Motors. Late in 1935, workers at several General Motors factories began a sit-down strike at their machines to demand better pay and working conditions. After 45 days, General Motors surrendered. It recognized that the Automobile Workers Union had the right to represent GM workers, and it agreed to negotiate a new work agreement.
The struggle at the Ford Motor Company was more bitter. Ford Company guards beat union organizers and workers. But the Ford Company finally agreed to negotiate with the new union. The same story was true in the steel industry. But the new labor leaders succeeded in becoming the official representatives of steel workers throughout the country. By 1938, the CIO had won its battle to organize major industries. In later years, it would join with the more traditional American Federation of Labor to form the organization that remains the most important labor group in America today, the AFL-CIO.
President Roosevelt was not always an active supporter of organized labor, but neither was he a constant supporter of big business, like the three Republican presidents before him. In fact, Roosevelt spoke out often against the dangers of big business in a democracy. These speeches caused great concern among many of the traditional business and conservative leaders of the nation. And Roosevelt's increasingly progressive policies in 1935 made many richer Americans fear that the president was a socialist, a dictator, or a madman. Former President Herbert Hoover, for example, denounced Roosevelt's New Deal policies as an attack on the whole idea of individual freedoms. The family of business leader J.P. Morgan told visitors not to say Roosevelt's name in front of Morgan. They said it would make his blood pressure go up.
This conservative opposition to Roosevelt grew steadily throughout 1935 and 36. Many Americans were honestly worried that Roosevelt's expansion of government was the first step to dictatorship. They feared that Roosevelt and the Democrats were trying to gain power as the Nazis did in Germany, the fascists in Italy, or the communists in Russia.
The Republican Party held its presidential convention in the summer of 1936. The party delegates chose Alfred Landon to oppose Roosevelt for president. Mr. Landon was the governor of the farm state of Kansas. He was a successful oil producer with conservative business views. But he was open to some of the social reforms of Roosevelt's New Deal. Republicans hoped he would appeal to average Americans who supported mild reforms, but feared Roosevelt's social policies. The Democrats nominated Roosevelt and Vice President John Garner to serve a second term.
The main issue in the presidential campaign of 1936 was Franklin Roosevelt himself. Roosevelt campaigned across the country like a man sure that he would win. He laughed with the cheering crowds and told them that the New Deal had helped improve their lives. In New York, Roosevelt made a major speech promising to continue the work of his administration if he was reelected.
Of course we will continue to seek to improve working conditions for the workers of America. Of course we will continue to work for cheaper electricity in the homes and on the farms of America. For better and cheaper transportation, for low interest rates, for sounder home financing, for better banking, for the regulation of security issues, for reciprocal trade among nations, and my friends, for all of these, we have only just begun to fight.
The Republican candidate, Alfred Landon, began his campaign by saying that many of Roosevelt's New Deal programs were good. But he said that a Republican administration could do them better and for less money. However, Landon's words became much stronger as the campaign continued. He attacked many of Roosevelt's programs. The campaign became increasingly bitter. Roosevelt said his opponents cared only about their money, not about other Americans. "I welcome their hatred," he said. Landon's supporters accused Roosevelt of destroying the nation's economic traditions and threatening democracy.
The nation had not seen such a fierce campaign in 40 years. But when it was over, the nation also saw a victory greater than any in its history. Franklin Roosevelt defeated Alfred Landon in the election of 1936 by one of the largest votes in the nation's history. Roosevelt won every state except Maine and Vermont. The huge election victory marked the high point of Roosevelt's popularity. In our next program, we will look at the many problems he faced in his second administration.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.